Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI marks the World Day of Prayer for Vocations with a special call to priests and parents. The bishops of Europe, together with a large delegation of experts, gather to discuss and propose practical projects to meet the needs and highlight the potential of migrants on the continent. The regional superior of the Jesuits in South Africa talks about the many challenges of a nation dealing with a rapidly developing democracy, as well as about the people's growing excitement as the World Cup football championship draws closer and closer. And film critic Peter Malone talks about an action and special effects movie dealing with the deities and myths of ancient Greece. Pope Benedict XVI on Sunday marked the World Day of Prayer for Vocations. Speaking to the pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square for the Regina Coeli, he exhorted the ordained ministers so that, inspired by the year for priests, they are moved to a stronger and more incisive witness to the gospel in today's world. And as Emma McCarthy reports, the Pope also encouraged parents to pray that their children have open hearts to listen to God so they can find vocational fulfillment and bear good fruit in the world.
Pope Benedict was speaking to thousands of pilgrims and visitors to St. Peter's Square for the traditional Regina Coeli prayer on the fourth Sunday of Easter, also known as Good Shepherd Sunday.
As we rejoice in the new lives, it's a reason Lord had won for us. Let us ask him to inspire many young people to center their hearts on the things of heaven.
Pope Benedict prayed that priests may know how to gladly stand before the tabernacle, totally committed to the vocation and mission through an austere asceticism, that they may become open to listening and forgiveness in order to form the Christian people entrusted to them and carefully cultivate the priestly fraternity.
Ringrazio tutti i presenti e quanti con la preghiera e l'affetto sostengono il mio ministero di successore di Pietro.
Saturday marked the fifth anniversary of the beginning of Pope Benedict's pontificate, and on Sunday he had special words of thanks for all those who, with prayer and affection, support his ministry as the successor of Saint Peter.
E infine rivolgo uno speciale saluto all'associazione Mater.
The Pope also used the occasion of Good Shepherd Sunday to thank and bless the work of an association founded by an Italian priest to combat paedophilia and online child pornography. For over 14 years, Mater Association has promoted the Italian National Day for children victims of violence, exploitation and indifference.
In particolare, i genitori, gli insegnanti.
On this occasion, said Pope Benedict in comments in Italian, I want to especially thank and encourage those dedicated to prevention and education, especially parents, teachers, and many priests, nuns, catechists, and facilitators who work with children in parishes, schools, and associations.
Confidently entrusting this petition to Mary, Queen of Heaven, I invoke upon you God's abundant blessings of peace and joy.
I'm Emma McCarthy.
Of course, you know Philippa Hitchin, my friend and colleague here at Vatican Radio's English feature programme. Well, she's currently on her way to take part in a meeting in Malaga, Spain, organised by the Council of European Episcopal Conferences, entitled The Europe of People on the Move, Overcoming Fears, Planning Projects. An interesting theme for sure, so just before going, I got her to tell me more about it.
The conference is organised by the Council of European Bishops' Conferences, which brings together the presidents of 35 bishops' conferences throughout Europe, but there'll also be other delegates attending, about 100 people, including national directors of pastoral care of migrants organisations, people working in the field on this critical issue of migration. The theme, as you say, is people on the move in Europe, overcoming fears, outlining prospects, and it's divided into three broad areas. First of all, the effect of migration on the family. Secondly, the effect of migration on community parish life. And thirdly, a sort of broader look at the effect of migration on society as a whole in Europe.
I understand, Philippa, that you are particularly being called to comment and, say, wrap up a series of interventions on the theme of the family.
Yes, there'll be a couple of presentations and then workshops to really try and thrash out some practical ideas about how family life is being affected by migration and how the church can take a positive, a more constructive role perhaps in trying to address some of the issues, particularly areas like, for example, the education of children. I mean, you know yourself, in schools here in what was once such a very Catholic country, now schools are full of children with Orthodox backgrounds from Eastern Europe, perhaps Muslim children coming in. This is obviously a phenomenon that's affecting all sorts of other European countries as well. How does that affect the church role? How do you teach religious education in that very multicultural, multi-religious context? But also in old age, it's not just the children. What about the migrants when they become older? What kind of assistance, what kind of rights, what kind of social security do they have in their old age to have a decent standard of living when they're no longer working as carers or gardeners or drivers or whatever the jobs that they've been doing? What kind of guarantees do they have? What about, obviously, mixed marriages? This is another huge area of interest. How is the church responding to these challenges? Priests, as we know, are already overtaxed in their duties. How do they respond to this enormous, if you like, ecumenical and interfaith issues that are being raised by mixed marriages and mixed families more generally?
Well, absolutely. These are all topics that touch each and every one of us. It seems to me that the CCEE has had this issue to heart for quite a while now. It's not the first time they've organised seminaries, conferences, whatever, on migration and on overcoming fears as such. Can you tell us a little bit about CCEE and how it works?
Yes, as I say, the organisation brings together the presidents of these 35 bishops' conferences throughout, very broadly across the European continent and also slightly beyond that. And it deals with a number of areas, but clearly any issue that they are touching on, any area that they come together to discuss at their meetings, obviously is influenced by this huge phenomenon of globalisation and this massive movement of people across the continent, both within Europe and also from developing countries here into Europe. So they're constantly looking at questions of why people move. People who come seeking asylum, obviously, from conflict countries, people who are coming, so-called economic migrants, seeking better jobs in Europe. And it's often, as you probably know, it's often the churches which are trying to provide some kind of voice, if you like, a Christian perspective on this question, which is so often seen by the media, by politicians, as simply a problem, a security issue. In fact, this theme, overcoming fears, which are raised very much by this kind of concept we have of waves of people invading our country. And you know the kind of politics that have exploited that sense of fear. So the church very much in the forefront of trying to look at what are the positive aspects of this migration. You know, the huge impact that it has on providing different cultural influences to the parish life, to church life. But as I said before, also the challenges. You know, what does it mean to suddenly a priest to find that he has an enormous Polish or Spanish speaking community or maybe languages that he doesn't know at all? How do you respond to those challenges? So this is an area that the CCEE is definitely very much dealing with this in most of its meetings these days.
What happens at the end of this conference? You wrap up at the end of the week. I imagine there'll be some kind of document will be drawn up.
Yes, the idea I think is to bring together, to listen to as many different voices as possible, people working, as I say, in the field very directly with migrants and with those, you know, these particular issues that we've been talking about, and to try and thrash out some very practical ways which could then be of use to the churches in all these different countries, some practical ideas in which they can respond to the challenges that we'll be talking about.
That was Philippa Hitchin talking about a conference on migration organised by the Council of European Episcopal Conferences from the 27th of April to the 1st of May.
Vimbo, vimbo mfana. Vimbo, 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 vimbo
One of the countries most definitely in the news these days is South Africa. And that's mainly because this is a football-crazy world we live in. And very, very soon, South Africa will host the 2010 World Football Championships. Yes, I know that's not everybody's cup of tea. And yes, I know there are a lot of other more important or more urgent issues that deserve attention. But let's face it, it really is the chance to shine the light on a nation that's trying hard to show its best side. It's preparing to hopefully welcome hundreds of thousands of football fans, and even the bishops of Southern Africa are doing their bit in preparing the ground for an event that has charged up the economy, provided jobs and revenue, and promises to bring the beauty and the potential of the nation to world attention. A nation that has undergone momentous change in the last 15 years, since the demise of the hateful apartheid system and the birth of democracy. However, the challenges faced today by the government, the church and the people are many. First and foremost, probably, the widespread poverty. I jumped at the chance to talk about some of them with someone who dropped into the radio the other day after having attended an important meeting. He is Jesuit Father David Smolira.
Well, I'm the regional superior of South Africa. I've been superior there for 2 years now. And my work as regional superior is there are only 24 Jesuits in South Africa, so not a large number of people, but nevertheless involved in a variety of different works there.
Father Smolira offered to explain exactly what he and his brother Jesuits in South Africa do.
We're really only in two locations now in South Africa, in Johannesburg and in Cape Town. Two communities in Johannesburg and one in Cape Town. We have three university chaplaincies, we have three parishes, and in addition to that, we have the Jesuit Institute, which is based in Johannesburg, and the real focus of that is to try and encourage dialogue between the church and civic society. We do a number of other things. We do some teaching, we do some adult education, lay formation, a lot of spirituality work, training of spiritual directors. But what we try and do in all of those very different works is to try and come at it as holistically as possible from a variety of different perspectives, theology, philosophy, psychology, economics, and so on. But in all of the work that we try and do, trying to encourage people to engage in dialogue.
In the past 15 years, things have changed a lot with problems coming to the forefront and other things being ironed out. What would you say are your major challenges at this particular time?
Well, first of all, as you can tell from my accent, I'm not South African, so I've only been in South Africa for the last 3 years. So I'm coming in very much as a newcomer and as an outsider. So I'm not sure that, in a way, I'm the best person to comment on a lot of that more recent history and the very dramatic changes that the country's experienced. I think, from my perspective, one of the key challenges that South Africa faces is the whole issue of how does a rapidly developing liberal democracy take account of, respect, and integrate the various value systems that have been part of its heritage, including the value system, obviously, from my perspective, the value system of Christianity and of the Catholic Church. And I think that what's going on in South Africa at the moment politically is partly that struggle of how to allow religious values and a religious perspective to be incorporated into the developing political, economic, social life of South Africa, without it being something that's imposed on others.
I had the Archbishop of Johannesburg in during the Synod, actually, in October.
Right. Uh-huh.
And he said something very strong. He said, "We have lost our moral high ground." You were referring to what's going on in South Africa
Sure.
at the moment.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that statement?
I think what it's true to say is the church has lost its voice to a large extent. I think When the apartheid regime was in operation, the church was very strong in its opposition to that and had a very strong social justice message. And I think since 1994, at least from what people tell me, the church has somewhat lost, not just the Catholic Church, but the Anglican Church and others as well, I think has somewhat lost its voice. And I think now, where we are facing a number of challenges in South Africa, I think that we are trying again to be able to speak out and to be able to speak for justice and to speak for development and speak for progress. But I think we are to some extent compromised. I think our position has been damaged.
When you speak of a number of challenges, I imagine you refer to criminality, to an increase in corruption at a political level, maybe a loss of a moral stand on part of your politicians.
I mean, I think those are certainly challenges that we face, but I think there are others too. There's an awful lot of people had an awful lot of hope from 1994 about the future. And though I think the government has done a lot in terms of addressing a lot of socioeconomic challenges, I think there are huge challenges that remain in terms of housing, in terms of education, in terms of rebuilding some of the infrastructure in South Africa to improve the quality of lives of the majority of the population. And I think a lot of people are somewhat disappointed with the high hopes, maybe unrealistic hopes that they had, and how to manage those hopes now in the light of progress, undoubtedly, but maybe not as much progress as they had hoped for. So I think there's quite a lot of disappointment, probably even disillusionment. And I think some of the tensions that have been present in the country recently are sort of an added dimension of disappointment that I think many people struggle with.
You were saying earlier that there aren't really many Jesuits in South Africa. Mm. Do you foresee an increase in the Jesuit presence there?
I would love there to be more Jesuits in South Africa. There's certainly, at least from my perspective, there's plenty of work for us to be doing, and we could do an awful lot more if we had more men. It's very difficult to see where those men would come from. I've been here in Rome having a meeting with the other major superiors from Africa, looking at how to develop the mission and the ministry of the Society of Jesus in Africa. And one of the things that I was saying was that at the moment, vocations in South Africa, there are not many people coming forward, certainly to religious life and not to the Society of Jesus. And so I was asking for help from other provinces in Africa to send a relatively small number of people to help us, partly to help us in our work, but also partly to help us to recruit young men from South Africa to join the society and help us in our work there in the service of the church.
Did you get a positive response?
Yes, I think I got a positive response in principle. The difficulty is that the society all over Africa is really still quite young. A lot of men in formation, a number of provinces, very good, very impressive young men, but also huge demands in their own countries. And so provincials have got responsibilities, obviously, to use their men locally in the service of the local church there, but also a growing sense among the provincials of solidarity for the society throughout Africa. So I'm optimistic about being able to get at least a few men from other provinces and regions in Africa to come down and help us in our work.
Also because South Africa is such a vast territory and very diverse as well.
It is a big country with quite a big population, quite a small number of Catholics relative to the overall population. But as I said a few minutes ago, we're only in two places in South Africa at the moment. And obviously we need to be, if we can, more widely spread and to be able to better serve people there.
Would you say Africans are religious people, aren't they?
Oh, yes. I think there's a very strong religious sensitivity in African people. And certainly in South Africa, religious practice is not the exception, but the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And a religious sensitivity, not just a religious practice, but a religious sensitivity. So, yes, I think both culturally and religiously, there's an enormous treasure house there, and something that people are not afraid to talk about. I mean, coming from Britain, religion is almost an embarrassment to many people, and it's not something to talk about and not something to be open about in ordinary conversation and in your workplace, and that's very different in Africa, certainly in South Africa, certainly in my experience in South Africa. But there are challenges there too. As I said, this whole issue about how you develop a liberal democracy and yet still have those religious values, those religious traditions incorporated in a way that adds value to society but doesn't impose in ways that are counterproductive or divide people,
right,
and cause division and increase the challenges of the whole movement of reconciliation that obviously is still still needs to be at work in South Africa.
Or even deny or ignore the heritage, the very particular heritage of the people who have lived there for millions of years.
Absolutely.
Which is rich in spirituality as well.
Yes, yes.
In warmth, yeah. In the desire to communicate. I find South Africans very, very open people.
Yes, oh yes, very, very open, very willing to listen and very willing to engage in dialogue. It's a very... Honestly, it's a sort of very refreshing place to be.
At that point, I was smiling when I asked Father Zmalira whether he's optimistic.
Yes, I think I can honestly say that I am. I think it would be foolhardy to minimise the challenges that South Africa faces over the next 10, 15 years. But I am optimistic. I think there's an awful lot of energy, there's a lot of enthusiasm, there's a lot of hope. And there's a lot of reliance on God. And that sense of hope and that sense of optimism and that recognition that somehow God is at work in us and in society, I think, how can it leave us anything but optimistic? But we have to cooperate with the work of the Spirit, all of us, and I think that presents us with big challenges. We have to be able to talk. We have to be able to really dialogue and explore together and find ways forward. And I think there's a very unfortunate history that we have to overcome as well. And that has its challenges too. So challenges, yes, but I'm very optimistic.
Now, there's one question I can't not ask you.
Okay.
And it's the lead up to the World Cup in June and July. And
yes.
The whole world is talking about it. The Southern African Bishops' Conference has a special section dedicated to it. I think it's called The Church on the Ball.
On the Ball, yeah.
And Cardinal Napier has had quite a lot to say about it. What are the feelings of the people in your experience in this run-up?
I think people are really looking forward to it. Obviously, there's been a huge amount of work that's been going on, building up stadia and improving the infrastructure and all those sorts of things. I think from what everybody's saying, we're ready or near enough ready for that. And there's obviously a lot of enthusiasm and excitement. I think there's some disappointment on the part of some that many of the Africans, not just South Africans, but prices and costs of travel and costs of tickets and so on, mean that many people who would perhaps we would have hoped could have been able to be there may not be able to be there. And that's a bit of a disappointment. But yes, there's a great enthusiasm, maybe more enthusiasm than is warranted perhaps with the Bafana Bafana team. But
yes, I'm not going to ask you who you're rooting for.
We still have high hopes.
Now it's over to my friend, film critic Peter Malone, who heads the film office at CIGNAS, the World Catholic Association for Communication. Today he talks about an action and special effects film dealing with the deities and myths of ancient Greece.
I enjoyed Clash of the Titans. I remember thinking that the Clash of the Titans in 1981 was a bit silly, perhaps. Maybe there was a bit of snobbery with Laurence Olivier and Maggie Smith and Claire Bloom in the cast and wondering whether they should be portraying the Greek gods. But having got over that, I actually quite enjoyed the remake for the 21st century.
It's really a clash between gods and men, isn't it?
It is, because the people of Argos must have taken a cue from the 21st century, and they decided that they really weren't very interested in the gods and they didn't really want to pray, and that human beings were equal to or even better than the gods. And I'm afraid the gods didn't take this too kindly at all, Zeus and Hades particularly.
Have you seen what's happening out there? Have you even bothered to look?
They need to be reminded of the order of things. Turn them on each other.
The small glimpse that I had, it almost seemed like science fiction to me, with some monsters flying through the air and attacking the humans. Quite confusing.
Well, I suppose the It's an interesting point you make. I must think of that. I'm thinking that maybe the Greek myths were the science fiction of their day, with all these monsters. Pegasus, of course, not a monster, flying through the air, and hydras and krakens, and even the Medusa with her snakes. That must have been the ancient history science fiction. Anyhow, they're all there, not looking really like science fiction, rather looking like mythology and taking us back into that Greek world.
Maybe it was the giant scorpions that had me referring to science fiction.
Ah, yes, they surface. Perseus has to do battle with one, and then they seem to multiply. But just to spoil it, they actually get rather tamed and provide a kind of equivalent of chariots for the forces who have to travel very quickly over the countryside to confront even further monsters. So they become nice scorpions.
Well, I've picked out three little quotes from your review, Peter. The first says, "Action, action, action." The second says, "It's a rattling good show." And the third says, "One is tempted to say that this is a cracking good show." So
that was a terrible pun with the Kraken.
Release the Kraken!
So one has to be in the spirit to watch something like this, I think.
I would think so. It's a kind of, inverted commas, boy's own adventure. Mm. The French director is not too good at, say, dramatic sequences, and my guess is that when the DVD comes out, there'll be a lot of deleted scenes, especially of the Council of the Gods, because Danny Houston, for instance, is Poseidon, who should have got a good look in at this clash, and gets one line. So my hunch is that probably a lot more has been filmed, but they decided to do what they have to make sure that it's action and people, you know, stay involved, and so that's why I said it's a rattling good action show.
One day, somebody's got to say enough.
If I do this, I do it as a man.
But you are not just a man.
Let's just remember that it's got quite a cracking good cast as well.
Well, Liam Neeson doesn't look entirely comfortable as Zeus, but Ralph Fiennes as Hades is obviously enjoying himself immensely. He seems evil personified. Well, of course, he's Voldemort in the Harry Potter film, so he's used to this kind of thing. And, of course, with his diction, he makes an absolutely articulate and sinister Hades, surrounded often by black clouds. So, in one way, he steals a lot of the show.
OK, Peter, I don't know if I'm going to take myself to see that, actually, but you are.
The clue is boy's own adventure.
That was Peter Malone, head of the film office at Cygnus, the World Catholic Association for Communication. That's all from the English feature programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.